network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network in sports. There are updates. And updates. There are numbers. And numbers. There are sorrows. In sorrow, there is redemption. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the news. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
On air, in air, waves controlled. On air, in air, channel connection. And the moon turns to blood. A stream runs through. This is the network. Network.
This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
And the moon turns to blood. A stream runs through. And the moon turns to blood. This is the network. Network. And the moon turns to blood. A stream runs through. And the moon turns to blood. This is the network. Network.
This is the news.
This is the network.
This is the news.
This is the network.
My name is Liz Kirkus from Catskill, and you're listening to WGXC Acra, Catskill, and Hudson.
On Saturday, July 30th, tune in all sorts of creative community voices on the air at 90.7 FM, including at 10 a.m. It's time to turn on the news as the coup continues. And then 10:30 a.m., Joshua Fried is back this week with his Radio Wonderland show after a week off. He mixes New York City radio live onto Hudson Valley frequencies for a half-hour dance party every Saturday morning. At 11 a.m., it's time for Christian Hawkins' Here to Go show on the 12th aisle this month. Then at 3 p.m., the Radio Art Hour features works from Anna Raimondo and Mark Vernon. At 6 p.m., the Framework show features composers using field recordings in their work, and we'll hear this week from Thanos Christos, Hada Bastini, Mariam Servan, Manja Ristic, and Emmanuel Costini, among others. And tune in Mike Watt and the Watt from Pedro show at 10 p.m. on the radio at WGXC 90.7 FM.
Do you have 17 cents a day to support a platform for many diverse voices to have their say on the local airwaves? Just 17 cents a day, a monthly $5 recurring donation, can help keep local youth on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM. Your monthly sustaining support will keep the airwaves full of music from around the world and around the corner. WGXC needs 500 sustaining supporters to make sure there is one spot on the dial where the community can have access to its own airwaves. Make your pledge today at wgxc.org/donate and do your part to protect an important source of local news, information, and entertainment. With just 17 cents a day, you will do your part to protect your favorite frequency. Become a sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org/donate now.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Amy Rigby of Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC Daily News for Friday, July 29th. Go to the WGXC newsroom, wgxc.org, with more about these stories. Kathleen Moore is reporting for the Times Union that the New York State Department of Health announced July 28th that monkeypox is an imminent threat to public health. The declaration provides local health departments access to additional state reimbursement for response and prevention activities. Monkeypox is spreading rapidly, Commissioner of Health Dr. Mary T. Bassett said in a statement. Anyone can get the virus, which is primarily spread through close physical contact between people. Although men who have sex with men constitute the majority of those infected right now, the virus does not differentiate. Anyone can get monkeypox. Contact does not have to be sexual. A baby and a toddler contracted monkeypox from their parents in other states. Because sexual contact is a common way to get the virus, the state health department advised all sexual partners to discuss whether they have any rashes or other monkeypox symptoms before skin-to-skin contact. If one person has symptoms, they should isolate at home and contact a health care provider for treatment and pain relief. The person should isolate from pets as well as people. An additional 110,000 doses of vaccine will arrive in New York during the next 4 to 6 weeks, Governor Kathy Hochul said. The vaccine is 2 shots, given 4 weeks apart. The person is fully vaccinated 2 weeks after the second dose. New Yorkers can sign up to receive mobile messages about cases and where to get tested or vaccinated by texting monkeypox to 81336. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Paul Kirby reports for the Daily Freeman that Central Hudson Gas and Electric said July 27th that natural gas prices will sharply rise effective August 1st. The supply for natural gas will increase by 20% to 87 cents per 100 cubic feet, up from 72 cents in July, according to Central Hudson spokesperson Jeff Jenkins. He said that while the use of natural gas is typically lower during the summer months, supply prices quoted on bills and overall bill impacts will vary for individual customers depending on their billing cycle and energy use. Jenkins noted that the New York State Public Service Commission and other watchdog agencies had warned of continued rising energy prices. This increase comes on the heels of a slight jump in electricity supply prices from $4.18 per kilowatt hour in June to $5.83 per kilowatt hour as of July 13th. Jenkins said the August electricity supply rates will not be known until August 9th or 10th. The utility said that the new rates were approved by the PSC as part of a 3-year plan in November. The approved plan includes another increase in delivery charges in July 2023. This year, the utility has been under fire for billing complaints and skyrocketing customer bills. The Public Service Commission, as well as a state Senate committee, are investigating those matters. The utility announced last week it will reinstitute late fees beginning in October. Read more about the story in the Daily Freeman. Mid-Hudson News reports that Frontier Airlines, which operates flights to various destinations from New York's Stewart International Airport, has started a cadet program to train the next generation of Frontier pilots. Frontier will operate its program in partnership with ATP Flight School. System-wide, the airline industry is facing a pilot shortage. Frontier is hoping to enroll up to 35 people each month to become commercial airline pilots. No prior flying experience is required, the company said from its Denver headquarters. Cadets will receive assistance in applying for financial aid to help offset training and living expenses. The program will take 24 months to complete. Cadets must be at least 19 years old, willing to relocate, and clear a background check. An associate degree or higher is preferred but not required. Participants must pass all required tests and obtain all necessary certifications before becoming a Frontier pilot. Read more about the story at MidHudsonNews.com and read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at WGXC.org.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, July 29th. Early morning temperatures range from 60 degrees in Courtright Center to 67 in Kingston. Soil temperature seems to be holding at 70 degrees. Dew points stay mostly comfortable around 61 today as temperatures rise to 88 degrees by 4 p.m. A small chance for rain shows up in the afternoon as temperatures start to drop. Overnight, temperatures get comfortable by 10 p.m. and fall to 61 degrees by dawn. On Saturday, we see a similar day, not too humid, with a high of 83. Overnight, hits 60 degrees. Then, Sunday, we see another nice day, high of 87. Monday, temperatures creep back up to 90 degrees, and it's still dry. Pollen levels for today will be medium. Today's tide schedule is high tide at 4:04 a.m., low tide at 10:59 a.m., high tide again at 4:44 p.m. and low tide once again at 10:52 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 79 degrees. Great for accelerating growth of bacteria like E. coli and Bacillus megaterium. Sunset today will be at 8:05 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:42 a.m. Looking way up, we see open coronal holes are releasing plasma due to arrive early next week. Solar wind speed is currently 370 kilometers per second at 4.4 protons per milliliter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair below 4 megahertz till dark, then fair across the board overnight. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 2. Quiet. The current sunspot number is 50. And this has been the Better Weather brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate. Get out there and enjoy the weekend, everybody.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Look, this bill is far from perfect. It's a compromise. But it's often how progress is made, by compromises.
President Joe Biden from the White House Thursday pleading for Congress to pass the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022. In addition to inflation, the bill also addresses climate change, taxes, and health care. Biden said it's no surprise that the economy is slowing, but the country is on the right path. Shortly after a new government report showed the economy shrank for the second straight quarter, reviving fears of a recession and criticism from Republicans on the president's economic policies. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen staunchly maintained the U.S. is not in a recession.
Most economists and most Americans have a similar definition of recession: substantial job losses and mass layoffs. That is not what we're seeing right now.
In the Senate, South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham and Connecticut Democrat Richard Blumenthal introduced a resolution that would designate Russia as a state sponsor of terrorism. Here's Graham.
And the sooner we make that statement, the more likely other countries will jump on board to punish Putin.
Massachusetts Democrat Ed Markey introduced a Senate bill reinstating net neutrality and the Federal Communications Commission's authority over broadband service.
The Net Neutrality and Broadband Justice Act will undo the Trump FCC's damaging deregulation, which left broadband access unregulated and consumers unprotected.
Veterans Affairs Department officials testified on sexual harassment issues at the agency and what they're doing to combat them before a House committee. The department's Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Office of Resolution Management, Diversity and Inclusion, Harvey Johnson, said the agency relies on an outpatient survey to gauge experiences.
The survey inquires generally about veterans' feelings of safety while attending appointments.
The Biden administration warned U.S. businesses and health insurance providers that limiting coverage of birth control, now that Roe v. Wade has been overturned, would violate federal law. Meanwhile, pro-choice Democratic lawmakers continue to voice disapproval on legislation restricting women's access to abortion and reproductive health services. California Democratic Representative Barbara Lee.
We cannot accept a world in which people are criminalized for making their own health care decisions. We are not going back.
I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. For generations, many Ohio residents have worked in the coal industry.
I personally am a coal miner's daughter. My grandfather and my great-grandfather were both miners.
That's Gwen Stewart of the Ohio State University Extension in Noble County. She says the coal industry shaped people's lives and identities. But as the country transitions to cleaner forms of energy, many coal mines and power plants are shutting down. So Stewart is part of an effort to explore what coal communities are going through and share their stories through exhibitions and performances. The team, led by Jeffrey Jaquette of Ohio State, has collected photos and interviewed about 50 former miners, power plant employees, and local residents.
It can be traumatic for folks to grapple with the significance of these changes. We've had lots of grown men getting emotional in interviews, and lots of tears have been shed over the meaning of these changes in these places.
Stewart says the project provides space for people in these communities to grieve the past and consider the future.
I see a lot of resilience and strength in the people and the leaders. I do see that they're working together. There's a collaborative spirit toward what's next.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1969. That was the day AFSCME sanitation workers in Charlotte, North Carolina, walked off the job. More than 85% of the sanitation workers were black in this predominantly white southern city. It was their third garbage strike in a year. State statutes prohibited union contracts in municipal agencies, but AFSCME was determined to win union recognition and establish an agreement with the city. Southern director for AFSCME, James Pierce, thundered, quote, "We'll bring in whatever help we can get if the city tries to break the strike. We can turn this place into a Memphis or a Charleston in a few days." Of course, Pierce was referring to the two victorious strikes by black workers that had rocked the South within the past year. Black sanitation workers in Memphis walked out in a historic strike in the spring of 1968. Hospital workers in Charleston, South Carolina, had just won their strike days earlier. Pierce outlined the issues at stake. According to the Asheville Citizen-Times, the Charlotte City Council had adopted its final budget without providing dues checkoff, without adhering to established grievance procedures or seniority rights, and without adding important safety precautions for garbage collection. At first, Charlotte's mayor asserted claims that the strike was about dues checkoff, but Pierce shot back about broken promises regarding the establishment of safety committees and non-discrimination enforcement. By the end of the month, a tentative agreement was in place. Strikers won all demands except dues checkoff. But as hospital workers soon found out in Charleston, South Carolina, the city council refused to carry out its agreement with the union. Sanitation workers in Charlotte would strike twice, unsuccessfully, over the next year and a half.
Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
On July 25th, Democrats Josh Riley and Jamie Chaney both spoke at a candidate forum for the New York 19 new congressional district. In Delhi, they spoke, and the special election they're running against each other in is on August 23rd. Here is one question asked to Democrats Jamie Chaney and Josh Riley.
Jamie, we will start with you. So our first questions all deal with more local issues, and then we'll get into some of the national issues. Jamie, what relationships do you have in our district that could form a basis of support through activism, organizing, work, or personal networks to make a successful campaign? And part two, how will you communicate and collaborate with constituents in office if you win?
Absolutely, that's an excellent question because it is the basis of any good campaign, any good representation. So my professional background has been working with companies that work across New York State. We have companies that work within the district. I think, though, more importantly, particularly when we look at this campaign, the reality is we do not win this district on Democratic turnout. We need someone who can truly pull crossover, and not just in theory, but can actually point to voters who are ready to cross the aisle because of their demonstration for doing work for this district and for the state as a whole. I have been very, very involved in agriculture in New York State for the last decade. I've been very involved specifically in the 4-H program, for those of you who are familiar with that. And a couple weeks ago when I was actually out in Ithaca, someone said to me, "Wait, there's something going on at the Dutchess County Legislature you need to know about." And I said, "Well, Dutchess County, that's not in the district." And they said, "Well, no, it's not, but..." So as you are all probably aware, Mark Molinaro, our GOP opponent, presides over the Dutchess County Legislature currently, and someone from our local agricultural community, someone who I don't know well, he has a farm near ours, but someone who's seen me roll up my sleeves in this community for the last 8.5 years at this point, went to the legislature to use the public comment period to say to Mark, "I just heard Jamie Chaney's running for Congress, and I'm here to tell you that I'm switching my party registration. I'm a lifelong Republican. And I'm going to vote for her because I've seen her roll up her sleeves. I've seen her roll up her sleeves at county fairs. I've seen her roll up her sleeves at 4-H. I've seen her roll up her sleeves when buying and selling steers. I've seen her in action. I know she's committed to this community, and I know she'll do the work." Having a network like that that doesn't just play on our traditional democratic networks, but allows us a true path to crossover, is going to be the key to this election. This is a district where we have to have crossover to win. In terms of how we will work closely with communities, I think Representative Delgado did a phenomenal job, and it's something that we're hearing about on the ground from independents, Republicans, and Democrats alike. He truly took the time to build advisory councils and took into account communities' views on his bills. So we will do that as well. I will say, though, that we will go one step further. So while he famously did that in agriculture, and that's the advisory council that you often hear about, we've heard from two groups that say repeatedly, we wish there'd been an advisory council to join. We look forward to forming those councils as well. Bipartisan, rooted in large and small communities, and bringing all of those views to the table for a meeting regularly.
That's great. Thank you, Jamie. I did let that go a little over, so I'll try to be a little bit more on top of that, and I'll give Josh an extra 30 seconds as well. Josh, same question.
All right, we're off to a great start. Well, first of all, Jamie, I hope you're feeling okay. Please get lots of rest, water, whatever the doctor orders. And I hope you're feeling better. Everybody, it's so good to see you. Thank you for organizing this and coming out. What a beautiful, beautiful setting to have this this conversation. So as Jamie helpfully pointed out, Mark Molinaro is from Dutchess County, which is not in this district. So the first part of my answer to this question is, as the only candidate in the race who was born in the district, who was raised in the district, who actually lives in the district, I think that's going to give us a big advantage in the general election against Mark Molinaro, who is outside of the district and abandoning his community to run here. Part of my deep ties in this district actually come right here to Delhi. When I was growing up in Endicott in the late 90s, early 2000s, my family worked in the IBM plants that we had there. My dad was a maintenance worker. And I remember when the news was coming out about the layoffs and the plant closed down. And my dad saw the writing on the wall that IBM was going to close down, all those jobs were going to get shipped overseas. And what he did was he went to his manager and asked to be placed on the graveyard shift at the plant. That's the shift that works overnight. And he did that so that he could go to work at night while IBM was still open, come home in the morning, he'd take a quick shower, grab a bite to eat, and then he'd jump in the car and he drove out here to Delhi to take landscape architecture classes at SUNY Delhi, because you can't ship those jobs overseas. And he got his college degree. He never had a college degree, didn't attend college until 2004. I make fun of him because it was a year after I got mine, so I beat him to it. But I got to tell you, he did that and took those classes with kids who were half his age at that point. And I think that took a huge amount of courage. And I've never been so proud of anybody as I was of my dad coming out here to Delhi to get his degree. And what it taught me is that when we face adversity, we pull together, we push through, and we fight back. We don't cower from it. When my dad saw the plants were closing down, instead of cowering and saying, woe is me, he asked to go on the graveyard shift so he could take classes over here at SUNY Delhi. And I'll tell you what, we as a country and a community are facing some really big challenges right now. We had a Supreme Court just tell us guns are more important than women. We've got a middle class that's eroding. We've got a planet that's burning and a democracy that's crumbling. And in the face of all that adversity, I'm telling you, we're going to pull together and overcome it. So,
on July 25th, Democrats Josh Riley and Jamie Chaney both spoke at a candidate forum for the New York 19 new congressional district. In Delhi, they spoke, and the special election they're running against each other in is on August 23rd. Here is one question asked to Democrats Jamie Chaney and Josh Riley.
So we're going to move on to some national issues now. The first one is reproductive rights. So you both state that you support a woman's right to choose and codification, even if we can pass reproductive rights legislation in Congress. How would you address the possibility of of Republicans overturning legislation or the Supreme Court overruling legislation? Please detail the steps you'll take to ensure reproductive rights if you are elected. And please be specific. I'm going to hand this one off to Josh first.
Thank Thank you. So the work on this issue can't wait. So every Democrat who's running for any office across the country should promise you in no uncertain terms that they will support codification of Roe. If they're not making that promise to you, they're not worth your time or your vote. I support unequivocally codification of Roe, and I'll do it on day one. There are so many other things we need to do, though, creatively with the legislative and congressional oversight process to overturn the Dobbs decision. One of the things I've already been working on so that we can hit the ground running on day one in Congress is having the Justice Department enforce women's right to FDA-approved abortion medications. Those are authorized right now for up to 10 weeks, and they account for about half of abortions in the country right now. I sent a letter to the Justice Department. I've been in contact with some of their senior leadership, asking the Justice Department, regardless of what's going on with Roe, to sue states that are trying to restrict access to those medications, because state laws restricting access to federally approved medications are clearly unconstitutional. That's the type of creative legal thinking and thinking outside the box we need to engage in, because this is a huge, huge challenge if we're just relying on the legislative process. Let me give you just one other really quick example. After Roe v. Wade was decided in the 70s, a bunch of anti-choice lawmakers passed what was called the Hyde Amendment. It was a provision in our appropriations bills, basically our budget, that said federal funding can't be used to pay for reproductive health care in the Medicaid system. And that's been on the books for a long, long time. Right now, we need to turn the tables on the anti-choice lawmakers, and we need to put amendments in the budget that says federal money is not going to states that are restricting women's access to health care services. If it was good enough for them to do it and hurt reproductive rights, then it's good enough for us to do it in this moment to be on the right side of that issue.
Jamie?
I'm going to go ahead and turn my video off again. This issue is personal to me. I'm very open about the fact that I am alive today because of abortion. There's health care. For those of you who haven't seen our TV ad we released last week, I made a decision to share that story because we need to make it clear that these are not things that are happening on the fringes. Abortion very much is health care, and we need to make sure that every woman has the right to the very decision that I made that saved my life and my family. In terms of legislative work, we need to pass the Women's Health Protection Act. We need to overturn the Hyde Amendment. We need to protect access to medication abortion. We also need to pass the Equal Rights Amendment. I have spent my professional career, though, unpacking issues for working women and working families. And sometimes they're not only the issues that are on the surface. And I believe that this is an element of what's happening with Roe. There's a legislative work that needs to be done, and then there is simply the underinvestment in women's healthcare that we have made across the board. 90% of the 19th district is in OBGYN desert. That means that someone needs to drive over an hour for OBGYN healthcare. What does that mean for the 15-year-old girl who's seeking out contraception? What does that mean if she suspects she's pregnant and she's trying to get information to make a decision by a certain point in her pregnancy where she might be comfortable with the decision, or God forbid, state law prevents her from making a decision that might be right for her? I think we need to look at the whole picture. This is where someone who can speak to this from lived experience can say this is about a law and it's about so much more. It's about underinvestment and under support of women's health care in this country.
Thank you, Jamie.
We're joined by Krista Estorfer, who is the Child Nutrition Program Specialist with Hunger Solutions New York, which helps coordinate work on hunger and particularly the federal anti-hunger programs here in New York State. And we asked Krista to come on because the Child Nutrition Program Reauthorization, which comes up every 5 years, is right now going through that process. So, Krista, why don't you give us a very, brief introduction. What is Hunger Solutions, and, what is the Child Nutrition Program Reauthorization bill all about?
Absolutely. Well, first, thanks so much for having me on today and for covering this issue. It can be hard.
W G X C.
This is Latitude Longitude. You are listening to WGXC
90.7 FM.
Acre, Catskill, Hudson.
WGXC.
Transmission art on air.
The airwaves as art.
Tune in the Radio Art Hour, Saturdays at 3 p.m. on WGXE, a show where art is not just on the radio, but is the radio.
Oh, radio, radio. Uh-huh. Radio.
The Radio Art Hour draws from the Wavefarm Broadcast Radio Art Archive, an online resource that aims to identify, coalesce, and celebrate historical and contemporary international radio artworks made by artists around the world. Tune in the Radio Art Hour, Saturdays at 3 p.m. on WGXE 90.7 FM.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Fridman Gallery in New York, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
The Public News Service Doha Newscast for July 29th, 2022. I'm Mike Clifford. A new study shows there is no place in Ohio, or the U.S. for that matter, where a person working at minimum wage full-time can afford a modest two-bedroom apartment.
The 2022 Out of Reach report reveals a significant gap between renters' income and their housing cost. Amy Regal with the Coalition on Homelessness and Housing in Ohio says rents have risen at a rate of about 12% in the last year and 20% over the last 2 years.
It's accelerating, and there's no signs that it's slowing down. This need will be more significant tomorrow, and in 6 months, it's going to be a drastic impact on our communities.
According to the U.S. Census Bureau, 109,000 Ohio households saw their rent increase by more than $250 a month during the past year. Mary Sherman reporting.
The report says due to decades of underfunding for federal housing, only 25% of eligible households receive the housing assistance that they need. And as part of New York State's climate goals, Governor Kathy Hochul has announced the third competitive solicitation of offshore wind projects. The hope is powering 1.5 million homes.
This comes after Hochul committed $500 million to offshore wind development earlier this year. The state's goal is to develop 9,000 megawatts of offshore wind by 2035. However, it isn't without cost to local communities, says John Polimeni, an economics professor at Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences.
With any new initiative, it is expensive to develop the ports. If your port is not currently prepared for wind energy, you need to do some changes to the port to make it accessible and proper for wind energy.
Polimeni, who's also a Schenectady City Councilman, says the short-term costs are small compared to the longer-term benefits that come from reducing dependence on fossil fuels. One of many planned offshore wind farms in New York will be up and running in 2024, generating power for the town of East Hampton. I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
The turbines will be 15 miles offshore. That's 8 miles farther than birds migrate and about 5 times farther than the human eye can see. Now from CBS News, the revelation late Tuesday that the DOJ investigation into January 6 includes questions about the actions of the former president and his allies, that's heightened speculation as to whether the former president could face legal trouble for his conduct related to the assault. As CBS reports at the DOJ, the critical question remains what federal crimes might be successfully brought and tried against the former president. This is PNS. Five projects in Michigan have been awarded grants from AARP to make communities more livable, especially for older folks.
Types of projects considered for the Community Challenge grants are those that improve public spaces, transportation, housing, digital access, and civic engagement, to name a few, and they must be completed by November 30th. Nicole Smith Anderson is with the Greater Flint Health Coalition, one of the grantees. She says their plan is to recruit volunteers and install raised beds in community gardens at food pantries and centers for older adults.
There's really a need for our senior population in particular to be physically active, to make sure that they have access to nutrition food. We've also found during the pandemic in particular, there's been a lot of social isolation.
Smith Anderson hopes the project will help foster a culture of healthy eating and physical activity through gardening. Studies also have shown that community gardens play a role in reducing crime. Other grantees include the City of Lansing, the Sable Points Lighthouse Keepers Association, Road to Freedom, and Arboretum Detroit. I'm Lee Wolke reporting.
And states like North Dakota need to reimagine their restitution laws for juvenile offenders. That's according to a new report.
In its findings, the Juvenile Law Center says as a young person goes through the criminal justice system, they often encounter a range of fees but usually don't have the money to pay them. Some also are required to pay restitution to victims. The Law Center's Nadia Mozafar says policies vary by state, but overall the approach is lacking.
Across the country, restitution is really a broken system that isn't working for young people, that actually isn't resulting in victims being appropriately compensated.
North Dakota is not among the states that has mandatory restitution. Judges have discretion in ordering a juvenile to repay the victim, but it is on the list of states that specifically grant crime victims the right to restitution from children or youth. I'm Mike Moen.
Finally, our Jonah Chester tells us as Virginia's farms continue to cope with unstable economic markets, one operation is blazing a new trail.
Established in 2019, the West Virginia-based New Roots Community Farm aims to provide resources and opportunities both for producers and consumers. Susanna Wheeler, New Roots' farm director, says the group develops and transfers land to the Agrarian Commons, a nonprofit that permanently preserves the land and leases it out to other farmers.
We felt that that brought more security and stability and also offered us an opportunity to really workshop this concept of what it means to operate on land held by another entity.
The Agrarian Commons aims to lower barriers for new farmers by signing long-term leases, which reduce upfront land acquisition costs.
This is Mike Clifford. Thank you for starting your day with Public News Service, member and listener supported. We're heard on great radio stations, your favorite podcast platform, and find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC News Update. Go to the WGXC Newsroom at WGXC.org for more information about any of these stories. Ariel Zangler reports in the Daily Freeman that the city of Kingston has declared a housing emergency. Rent control regulations can now be enacted on city properties built prior to 1974 that have six or more units. The Common Council voted 7-1 on July 28th for a resolution declaring a housing emergency in the city and enacting regulations under the state's Emergency Tenant Protection Act. Minority Leader Michael Oliveri, a registered Democrat who won the Ward 7 election on the Republican Party line, was the lone no vote. Mayor Steve Noble signed the legislation into law on July 29th. Quote, I am pleased to be able to codify this legislation and to implement these tenant protections here in Kingston, unquote, Noble said in a statement. Quote, we have known we have a housing crisis in Kingston, and this is yet another step we are taking to protect our residents and make sure that everyone who wishes to live in Kingston is able to. With this law, there are more than 1,200 rental units that are now entitled to rent stabilization, unquote. An undeclared housing crisis exists throughout the Hudson Valley, with few new affordable housing going on the market recently. The problem of higher rents and few available units was made worse by the pandemic, with an influx of new wealthy homeowners and renters moving to the area from New York City recently. Quote, we are living in a time where housing, in particular affordable housing, is almost non-existent, unquote, Majority Leader Rita Worthington, Democrat from the 4th Ward, said, quote, there is a housing crisis in our city. This resolution does not and will not solve the entirety of the crisis that we find ourselves in, but I do believe it is a step in the right direction, unquote. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman. Roger Hannigan Gilson in the Times Union digs into the financial disclosures obtained from the campaign of Jamie Chaney, candidate running for the new 19th congressional district seat in a primary August 23rd against fellow Democrat Josh Riley. Chaney has loaned her primary campaign $100,000. As an individual, Chaney has joint assets valued at between just under $4 million and just under $15 million, as candidates must only categorize their assets by ranges of value. She is a landlord to a property in New York City and another in Rhinebeck. She also owns and lives in a 65-acre farm in Rhinebeck. She's currently making money from consulting fees and dividends, as well as the rental properties. Quote, Jamie Chaney started a successful business that holds Wall Street accountable by advocating for working parents to have rights like comprehensive health care, child care, and flexible work hours, unquote, according to a statement from her campaign. Quote, she is running for Congress to protect reproductive health care, pass meaningful gun reform, and help working families across the district, unquote. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Nick Reisman reports for New York State of Politics that progressive New York lawmakers and environmental activists continue to push for a special session of the legislature to address climate change. Specifically, they want a vote on a bill meant to require the New York Power Authority to only provide renewable forms of power to customers. Quote, as elected officials, we owe it to our constituents to do everything we can to combat this existential crisis, unquote, said Assemblyperson Jessica Gonzalez-Rojas. Quote, our continued inaction will only perpetuate the injustices we were elected to address. Let's act with the urgency that the climate crisis demands, unquote. So far, Governor Kathy Hochul has given no indication she wants to hold a second special session this summer. After a spate of mass shootings, Albany lawmakers passed some gun laws in a special session earlier in the summer. Read more about this story at NewYorkStateOfPolitics.com. And read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at WGXC.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Sun Common, supporting vibrant communities across New York for over 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
On July 25th, Democrats Josh Riley and Jamie Chaney both spoke at a candidate forum for the New York 19 new congressional district. In Delhi, they spoke, and the special election they're running against each other in is on August 23rd. Here is one question asked to Democrats Jamie Chaney and Josh Riley.
Our next question is about affordable health care. Jamie, affordable health care is a significant issue in rural America, including Delaware County. What actions do you believe should be taken to expand access to affordable health care? Do you support, part two, do you support Medicare for all? Why or why not? And I'll give you a 30-second warning.
Again, a great question and one I think that impacts all of our lives every day. As you mentioned in the opener, I have spent my career thinking about the benefits that allow families to be successful and advocating for those benefits. And healthcare is at the top of the list. I have sat around a lot of tables articulating why this is the single benefit that we know companies must provide for working families. And we need to think about access in all ways. So we need to think about access in terms of cost, but I think the thing I am most struck by in this district is, well, the national conversation may be around cost. Cost becomes almost irrelevant if you simply can't get there. So not only do we need to address cost, but we need to address access. I have heard so many stories of people traveling an hour or 2 hours for a doctor's appointment unless they're willing to wait 6 months, and this is against a background where there's no child care, where gas costs $5 a gallon. And then someone says, well, how about telehealth? Let's do that. That should work. I think everyone there knows exactly how broadband works in this district. And while telehealth right now may seem like a great idea in our urban centers, this is exactly the reason I'm running, because we need to bring the reality of life in a rural district into the national policy landscape. If we're serious about telehealth, which can be a key part of healthcare access, we need to treat broadband in rural areas as a public utility. So I see those things as intertwined. In terms of Medicare for all, obviously the current proposal that's on the floor would probably triple our current federal budget. I'm also concerned about the fact that the benefits that many of our labor partners have worked for long periods of time to commit to their members wouldn't be honored under Medicare for All, and labor partners are a critical part of this conversation. That said, I strongly, strongly believe that healthcare is a human right and that there should be a public option.
Thank you, Jamie. Josh, is there a question?
Great. Yeah, So the first case I took out of law school, a lot of my classmates went to Wall Street and worked for the banks. I decided, of all places, to go to Florida to sue the Florida government, working in partnership with the American Academy of Pediatrics. And we argued, as part of that case, that healthcare in this country should be a civil right. And I believe that as much today as I did when I made that argument in court. Things we need to do right away around the healthcare system is, number one, let's all remember here as Democrats, we are all much better off on this issue than the Republicans who voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act. So the differences we all talk about around healthcare are on the margins when it's compared to a party that's trying to tear down the entire system. Some things that we should do immediately to improve access to healthcare, number one, I would like to lower the Medicare eligibility age down to 55 years old. So once you're 55, you can get into the program. What that actually does is strengthen the Medicare system by putting a healthier cohort into it. It also lowers the cost of private insurance by taking that oldest and least healthy population out of the private healthcare system. I would also allow Medicare to negotiate prescription drug costs. We're seeing so many families, so many seniors on a fixed income today who are really struggling to get by, making impossible choices between the medicines they need and the groceries to feed their family. There's no reason whatsoever that we can't negotiate prescription drug costs. The only reason we're not doing it is because the pharmaceutical industry has spent about $14 million in the 2020 election cycle buying politicians, shipping them down to Washington, and having them vote for the pharmaceutical industry's interests instead of for your interests. And so if we can do that, we can save billions of dollars in the budget and help families make ends meet. The last thing, just very quickly, there's a provision in Obamacare called the medical loss ratio. It basically says 85 cents of every dollar you spend on health insurance has to go to your care and not to lobbying and nonsense like executive compensation. I think it's time that we increase that and put more money into your care and less into profits.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. We're headed back to Ohio today, where on July 19th, the Ohio Supreme Court rejected another set of GOP-drawn congressional district maps because they were gerrymandered for partisan gain. You'll remember that Ohio's legislature had thrown up its hands and resubmitted a map previously rejected by the Ohio Supreme Court. The state was under pressure to get the maps in place for the Ohio primary on August 2nd, but now whatever maps are agreed upon will not be in force until 2024. The Associated Press reports that the rejected map created 10 safe Republican seats and 5 Democratic seats. However, the High Court's majority said the latest map packed surrounding Democrats into 3 of the Democratic-leaning congressional districts, which diluted the Democratic voting power and strengthened Republican power around heavily Democratic Cleveland, Cincinnati, and Columbus. The 4-3 decision by the Ohio Supreme Court cited the 2018 state constitutional amendment prohibiting partisan gerrymandering. GOP legislative leaders had said the rejected map was the best they could do, but the court included a fair map model in their opinion, giving a representative share of seats to both parties. The court gives the legislature 30 days from July 19th to come back with a fair map. If the legislature fails, it returns to Ohio's redistricting commission. Read the AP story and get connected with groups taking action at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. For the American Democracy Minute, I'm Brian Beal.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC Renewable Weather Forecast. And we start each renewable weather forecast off with the price of fossil fuels in Greene County. The Gas Buddy website says the lowest price for a gallon of gas in Greene County is at the Caro Mart in Caro. It's $4.46 currently. Then we look at the air quality forecast from the National Weather Service. And it is slightly worse than yesterday at 29, still in the good range. And then the UV forecast for Friday, July 29th is an 8. That's in the very high range when you're recommended between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. to wear a shirt, wear a hat, and put on sunscreen if you're out and about. The National Service in Albany says Friday should be mostly sunny, good for the local solar panels, with a high near 82 and a west wind around 7 miles per hour spinning local windmills. Friday night, there's a 20% chance of showers with cloudy skies gradually becoming more clear as the night goes on, and a low around 60. Saturday should be sunny with a high of 79 and a northwest wind spinning local windmills 8 to 13 miles per hour. Saturday night, clear is the forecast with a low around 57 and a west wind 5 to 9 miles per hour. And Sunday should also be sunny with a high of 84 and a low around 63. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, solar-powered radio for open ears. Friday, July 29th, tune in to all sorts of creative community sounds on the air on 90.7 FM, including at 10 a.m., Global Agogo Show is still on summer vacation, but Driftless Turmoil is in this week with music from Rachel Grimes, John Weiss, and Daniel Johnston, among others. And Jared Wigashud hosts the Sugar Shack Jukebox live from WGXC's Hudson Studio in the basement of the First Presbyterian Church on Warren Street. That's from noon until 2 p.m. 4 p.m., the WGXC Afternoon Show is live from Acre. Then at 6 p.m., we are live from Catskill, Main Street in Catskill, where the clubhouse is. Clubhouse Radio is on at 6 p.m. until 7 p.m. with local youth playing their music and telling their stories. 7 p.m., we hear from youth in Hudson, Georgia Yassi, Jada Pernetti, Fada Janet, Mashuda Sultana, and Amelia Ortiz are among the youth that host the Bound by Books show, talking with Emily Shimides from the Hudson Area Library about what they've been reading. That's on at 7 p.m. And then the local music show Hudson Valley Sounds is on at 8 on 90.7 FM WGXC. There's a reissue online of Brian DeWan's 1997 7-inch Free Lunch. Here is the children's story from J. Otto Seibold and Vivian Walsh, told by Catskill's Brian DeWan.
Free lunch, free lunch, free lunch, free lunch. Our story begins.
Mr. Lunch was very good at chasing birds. In fact, he was a professional. Every morning, Mr. Lunch liked to meet with the birds for bird chasing practice. To get ready to go really fast, Mr. Lunch would stretch his back and the birds would flap their wings.
One, two, three, four! One, two, three, four!
Afternoons were reserved for office work. There was a lot to do, such as reading the mail and placing birdseed orders.
Notice!
Notice! Notice!
Notice!
Change of elephant!
Change of elephant!
One afternoon, Mr. Lunch got a letter from the Elephant Brand Birdseed Company. It said there was a new elephant in charge. The old president was a good elephant with an excellent nose for seeds. Mr. Lunch wondered where he could have gone. Maybe the elephant went on one of his trips, thought Mr. Lunch. Mr. Lunch was happy to order some new seeds from the new elephant. But the new seeds did not make the birds happy. As time passed, the seeds became...
Goose, goose, rocks, rocks, rocks.
The matter was brought to Mr. Lunch's attention. He conducted a careful examination and determined that the seeds were indeed rocks. The birds didn't like rocks. Ambrose, the redbird, said, "I have an idea." He had a friend who lived in the country, surrounded by birdseed trees. "Maybe we should go visit," said Ambrose. Everybody liked Ambrose's idea. They gathered everything they would need to pick the seeds.
Wheelbarrow, field guide, ladder,
boot,
snack,
basket, and then drove off to find Ambrose's friend. Ambrose was happy to see his old friend. Her name was Gunhild. She showed them a good place to get started.
Welcome, Ambrose, welcome, Ambrose.
It was a lovely garden. But not everyone was so happy. High overhead, someone was spying on them. It was the new Birdseed Company elephant. He was very angry. He did not like to see birds eating free seeds. He did not like many things. He did not like Mr. Lunch. He hatched an evil elephant idea. Quickly, he painted a sign. It read, "Dogs must remain on a leash." Minutes later, the police arrived and arrested Mr. Lunch for being off the leash. Ambrose told the police they were making a big mistake. "That's for the judge to decide," said the officer. "I should probably arrest you, too, but I don't have a jail small enough to hold birds." Mr. Lunch was sure there had been a misunderstanding. He didn't even have a leash. He would explain his story to the judge and be set free.
Quiet, 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 quiet in the courtroom, quiet in the courtroom!
But the judge was an owl, and like all owls, she stayed up all night and slept all day. The judge never heard a word Mr. Lunch said. She was deep in sleep. Mr. Lunch would have to wait in jail. Now turn over the record and put on side two. Mr. Lunch had never been in jail before. Mr. Lunch spent his days looking for shapes in the clouds.
Bicycle.
Gum.
Australia.
Elephant.
Popcorn.
Food.
Chair.
Wig.
Bag. Phone.
Caterpillar.
Locomotive.
Cucumber.
Joe.
Baby.
Monkey. Bear. The nights were more lonely. Ambrose wanted to help Mr. Lunch. It was time to pay a visit to the bake shop. He asked the chef if he could hide something special inside a piece of cake. The chef said, no, no, that would not be right. That would be breaking the baker's code. He did have a little secret, though. One that could help Mr. Lunch.
Psst, psst.
A pink package was prepared. Ambrose and Gunhild delivered it to jail. Mr. Lunch was surprised when a piece of cake showed up. He ate it very carefully. He didn't want to swallow a file or anything. Mr. Lunch finished the cake without finding anything that could help him escape. He felt sad, but being a neat dog, he still took care to wipe his face. As he was cleaning around his eyes, he noticed that there was some writing on his napkin. It was a map. Ambrose had drawn an escape route. It turned out Mr. Lunch's jail room was right over an abandoned ruby mine. Mr. Lunch began to dig. He dug until he found a big surprise. It was the ex-president of the Elephant Brand Birdseed Company. And he was surrounded by shiny red rocks. Rubies! Even though he was upside down, Mr. Lunch could see that the elephant was feeling sad and blue. This was not on Ambrose's escape map. Mr. Lunch decided to investigate. The elephant was mumbling. As Mr. Lunch got closer, he heard, "Tricked, trapped, trick-trap, tripped." "I have been tricked into a trap," said the elephant. He told Mr. Lunch how the evil elephant had locked him up in the ruby mine so he could take over the birdseed company. Mr. Lunch knew this was true because he had been tricked by that elephant too. The evil elephant had sealed the mine with a big rock. There was only one chance for escape, a hole in the ceiling. But it was too small for an elephant and too high up for a dog. Things looked grim. Then the elephant had a good idea. Mr. Lunch shot through the roof and out into the nighttime sky. He was free!